Thank you for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. We are very honored and privileged that our guest today is Professor Noam Chomsky. We were fortunate that Professor Chomsky could join us to discuss some of the current events. The interview started with a discussion of President Obama's new nuclear deal with Iran. It was followed with a discussion of the United States' involvement in the Middle East and the chaos that happens whenever the United States gets involved there, from Iraq to Libya to Syria, just to name a few countries. Next, Professor Chomsky talked about Cuba and the history of the U.S. relationship with Cuba. And we ended the interview with a discussion of immigration, how the NAFTA trade agreement influenced the number of immigrants coming from Mexico, and what the United States could do to limit the number of immigrants from Latin America. Throughout today's interview, Professor Chomsky gave some examples of how the media coverage of the United States' involvement in the Middle East and in Cuba and Latin America is quite similar to the media coverage of the U.S. war in Vietnam in its early days. Professor Chomsky pointed out that when the media coverage of the United States' war in Vietnam changed and the American people became more informed about what was really happening, that helped change the public opinion and helped end the Vietnam War. Professor Chomsky is optimistic that eventually, when the media coverage of the U.S. involvement in the Middle East and different countries around the world changes and brings the truth to the American people, that will help change the public opinion and it will help make the world a better place. What do you think of President Obama's new nuclear agreement with Iran?
I think it's a step forward. There are many questions. I think it's rather likely that the Republican Congress will find a way to undermine it, perhaps by managing to maintain or impose further sanctions, which would in fact destroy it. If it goes through, it's a step forward. But we should be asking ourselves a number of questions. Today in the New York Times, there's an article in which Israel presents its demands for modification of the agreement. What right does Israel have to say a single word about this? Israel is the most aggressive state in the region. It's carried out 5 invasions of Lebanon. It's radically violating international law in the territories. Has a huge nuclear weapons store, refused to sign the non-proliferation treaty. It's a rogue state, just like the United States is. What right do they have to impose anything, or we for that matter?
Isn't Iran considered a rogue state too?
When you look at the charges against Iran, they're very interesting. There is a litany of charges. So, for example, Peter Baker had a think piece, front page think piece in the New York Times, the day of the negotiations in which he listed the charges against Iran. Now, they're very interesting to look at. So, for example, one of the charges is that Iran supports militias in Iraq which killed American soldiers, so they're destabilizing the region. In other words, when we invade Iraq, destroy the country, they kill hundreds of thousands of people, create millions of refugees, incite sectarian conflict, which is tearing the country and the region apart. That's stabilization. When somebody defends themselves against our aggression, that's destabilization. And that's taken for granted. In fact, a question that we might ask ourselves is, what is the Iranian threat supposed to be? It's common standard for political figures in the United States, including presidential candidates, Jeb Bush a couple of days ago, to say that the greatest threat to world peace is Iran, and then added the international community agrees that the greatest threat to world peace is Iran.
Do other countries believe American politicians when they say that Iran is the biggest threat to world peace?
About a year ago, there was a major poll of international opinion taken by the Gallup organization, the major polling organization in the United States. And one of the questions was, which country is the greatest threat to world peace? Iran was barely mentioned. By far, way in the lead was the United States. The world population regards the United States as the greatest threat to world peace. Nobody else is even close. Now, how can Americans know about that? Well, the press here simply refused to publish it. It was not published. It's a Gallup poll, major poll. So they can continue to say Iran is the greatest threat to world peace. Take, say, nuclear weapons. Suppose, we don't know, but suppose Iran is planning to develop them. What would the threat be? Well, there's an answer. It comes from the highest level of U.S. intelligence, a public report to Congress where they discuss security issues in the world and, of course, discuss Iran. And what they say is, if Iran were to develop a nuclear weapon, it would be part of their deterrent strategy. I mean, every strategic analyst, in fact, everyone with a brain functioning, knows that Iran, if it had a nuclear weapon, could not use it. If it even tried to use it, the country would be vaporized. So, of course, they couldn't use it, but it could be a deterrent. It could deter the two rogue states that rampage in the region, namely the United States and Israel, and they are unwilling to accept a deterrent. That's the threat of Iran. The Iranian government is a rotten government, and in many ways they're a threat to their own population, undoubtedly. But by international standards, they don't count as a threat. Nor does U.S. intelligence even regard them as a threat. But the threat would be potential deterrence. Now, none of this is discussed. What we see in the media is literally op-eds in both the national newspapers, Washington Post and New York Times, op-eds by prominent figures saying, let's bomb Iran. Suppose that in the Iranian press, say in Kaihan, you had op-eds appearing saying, let's bomb the United States. Where would the reaction be here? Well, you can guess. But when we threaten to bomb another country, or when Israel says maybe we should bomb Iran, as they regularly do, that's considered fine. All of these things reflect a conception of world order, which amounts to saying, look, we own the world. Anything we want to do, we can do. And if anyone resists it, they're criminals.
Do you have any idea about how many civilians died in Iraq and Afghanistan as a result of the U.S. involvement there?
There was recently a study by the major medical groups, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, Nobel Prize-winning group, Physicians for Social Responsibility, came out with a major report on casualties from the U.S. wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. Well over a million killed. That wasn't even reported. In the case of Libya, I would suggest that you have a look at a recent issue of Foreign Affairs, the main establishment journal, not a radical rag. There's an article on Libya by a well-known analyst who estimates that the NATO attack multiplied the number of casualties by at least a factor of 10. He points out that the war was practically over with very few casualties when NATO decided to attack. But the NATO attack greatly increased the number of people killed and turned the country into total chaos. And in fact, recall that the NATO attack was in violation of a Security Council resolution that the NATO powers had initiated. That resolution, which they used as a pretext for the attack, actually called for a ceasefire. It called for a no-fly zone to protect civilians and a ceasefire and negotiations. Actually, Gaddafi accepted that. NATO rejected it and instead became the air force of the rebels, practically destroying the country and killing a huge number of people. That's Iraq and Libya. How is this interpreted here? Well, it's very interesting. Take a look at the latest issue of Middle East Policy, one of the more liberal and critical of the scholarly Middle East journals. It features a long symposium of ambassadors, generals, high-level officials, in which they discussed what U.S. policy should be in the Middle East. It's taken for granted that the U.S. is committed to stabilization of the Middle East. And then there are many destabilizing elements like Iran. And the question that's raised is, how can we best continue our policy of stabilization? What's the policy of destabilization? Destroying Libya, destroying Iraq, initiating sectarian conflict that didn't exist before, spreading it throughout the region, it's not tearing the region to shreds. That's our stabilization. How can we continue that policy? It's the same on every issue. Take a look. Yesterday, there was an op-ed by Thomas Friedman, New York Times, the main diplomatic correspondent. He had an exclusive interview with President Obama in which Obama presented what Friedman calls the Obama Doctrine. Every president has to be a doctrine. The doctrine is engagement, but maintaining our power. And then Obama gives an example. The first example he gives is Cuba. He says, the moves to normalize relations with Cuba are sensible. We're willing to engage with them, but we're so powerful that there's no risk in it for us. And he says, we try these methods of bringing freedom and democracy to Cuba, as he's announced before. We've tried for 50 years to help the Cuban people to bring democracy and freedom. The methods we've used haven't worked very well, so let's try new methods. What are the methods that we've used to bring freedom and justice to Cuba? Well, one is a crushing embargo, which is denounced by the entire world outside of Israel, and is extraordinarily harmful to Cubans. And the other is a major terrorist war.
What kind of terrorist war did the United States start in Cuba?
Kennedy initiated a major terrorist war. It was a very serious one. The only thing we're allowed to mention here is a few attempts to assassinate Castro, and you can kind of dismiss them as CIA shenanigans. But the terrorist war was very serious, and in fact, it almost led to a nuclear war. It was one of the reasons behind the missile crisis. But you just can't talk about that. Those are the methods we've used to bring freedom and justice to Cuba. And why? Well, the United States is a pretty open society. We have a rich internal record of declassified documents discussing the reasons for actions. And the reasons in this case were quite explicit. It's what the State Department called back 50 years, for almost 50 years ago, Cuba's successful defiance. That's the phrase that's used. Cuba's successful defiance of U.S. policy going back to the Monroe Doctrine in 1823. That's when the U.S. declared its intention to dominate the hemisphere. And Cuba is defying this, and it's successful. And we can't accept that. So therefore, we have to carry out this destructive embargo and murderous terrorist war. But when it's transmuted into public rhetoric by the president, by the Times diplomatic correspondent and others, it becomes our noble effort to bring freedom and justice to the Cubans. This goes on all the time, not just Iran and Libya and the Middle East. And it's a reflection of a deep-seated imperial mentality, which essentially takes for granted that we pretty much own the world. And if anyone resists what we do, everything we do is noble and just. And if anyone resists it, they're criminals.
Do you think which president we elect in 2016 will make a difference, or are all the presidents of the United States the same and they all follow the same doctrine?
Until the population of the United States takes strong steps to reverse it. Otherwise, there's no reason for power systems or the ideological system, the media, to change what they do, their point of view. I mean, there are two factors that might change American policy. One is international resistance, which is not insignificant. The second is internal pressure by a mobilized public, which has an effect. had an effect on the Vietnam War, on other criminal acts.
How can the American public try and change things if the media does not report the whole truth, if the media does not report on civilian casualties, and if the media does not report on many of the things that you just discussed?
Well, that's your job. That's the job of people who want to reach the public. Yes, you have to get around media suppression. The examples I just cited are, I happen to be quoting the New York Times and the Washington Post, but because they're the major media, and of course they're also more or less on what's called the liberal side. It's not Fox News, so therefore they're extremely important. And this is just standard there. And yes, you have to overcome it. That's what activism is about. That's how the truth about the Vietnam War began to break through, not from the government, from the public opposition.
Are you planning to write any new books or articles about media suppression and how the U.S. involvement overseas is covered in the U.S. media?
I just wrote an article about it last night. It'll be published in Z Magazine and in Telesur. It's Venezuela's effort to create an international news outlet which reaches mostly Latin America.
The title of this new article by Professor Chomsky, in case you would like to read it, is One Day in the Life of a Reader of the New York Times, NYT, April 6, 2015. Have there been any documentaries made about your research and your work on how the media tries to influence people in the United States?
There's a well-known documentary called Manufacturing Consent, which is based on a book of which I was a co-author with that same title. It's about media and propaganda, and there are several others. You know, these reach popular audiences, but if the Gallup poll cannot reach a single American newspaper when it publishes the wrong thing, what are the chances for really critical work?
Well, we can try.
Yes, that's what we have to do. We have to keep trying.
You have a famous quote about optimism. Could you share it with us?
Well, I think I was quoting Gramsci, who said we should have pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will.
You're listening to KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you for joining us today for our interview with Professor Noam Chomsky. In this section of the interview, Professor Chomsky will discuss the immigration situation from Mexico and from south of the border and how we can improve this situation.
I think it's grotesque that people are fleeing from countries. Where are the immigrants coming from? Many are coming from Mexico. That's largely a result of NAFTA. In fact, at the very moment that NAFTA was instituted, you know, the North American Trade Agreement is called free trade, had nothing to do with free trade. Clinton started militarizing the border. Presumably the reason was that he, as well as most other people, understood that the effect of NAFTA would be to undermine the Mexican economy. I mean, it's presented as if it was a great economic opportunity. In fact, Mexico has had the lowest growth rate among major countries of Latin America since NAFTA was instituted. Mexican farmers, campesinos, can be perfectly efficient, but they can't compete with highly subsidized U.S. agribusiness. So they're driven off the land. Mexican businesses can't compete with U.S. multinationals that must receive national treatment, like Mexican businesses under NAFTA. So it'll undermine those sectors of the Mexican economy, and all of this will lead to people fleeing. Other refugees, the main source of refugees now, apart from Mexico, is Honduras. Why Honduras? Well, because in 2009, there was a military coup in Honduras, which threw out the mildly reformist president. The U.S. is one of the only countries that essentially endorsed the coup. You know, didn't say that many words, but it's been supporting the coup regime and even claimed that the election under the military coup was legitimate, which almost nobody did. And the result has been a total horror story in Honduras, kind of like Libya, some of the worst atrocities in the hemisphere, and people are fleeing in fear and misery. Others are fleeing from Guatemala. Why Guatemala? I mean, there are people fleeing today from the Mayan highlands in Guatemala, where there was a virtual genocide in the early 1980s backed by the United States. If you carry out monstrous crimes and destroy countries, you're going to have people fleeing. Well, they flee across the border if they happen to make it. It's not easy. They're rounded up, put into trucks, given a totally fraudulent legal hearing, and then dumped across the border. It's totally grotesque.
How can the United States deal with the immigration from Mexico and Guatemala and other Latin American countries in a better way?
There are perfectly civilized ways to deal with this. The obvious way, these people aren't fleeing to the United States because they want to leave their countries. They're fleeing mostly because they can't survive in their own countries, partly because of U.S. policies. Well, we could institute policies which make it possible for them to do what they want, live in peace in their own countries. After all, we're responsible for a lot of what happened there. That would be a constructive response. Other than that, you know, there ought to be pretty free movement of people. You look at the trade agreements, so-called free trade agreements, they're not that. But what they do is free capital, but imprison people. They don't permit free movement of people, just free movement of capital. That's in radical violation of free trade. You go back to, say, Adam Smith. One of his principles was that free circulation of labor, free movement of labor, is a prerequisite for free trade. But these systems are designed for the benefit of investors, where people don't count. So capital can move, but people can't. And that's only one of a great many such provisions in these agreements, which have nothing to do with free trade. They're basically investor rights agreements, which are often very harmful to people in all the countries involved. And the immigration problem is part of that.
You've been listening to Modern Tech News on KCSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you for joining us today, and we would like to thank our guest, Professor Noam Chomsky, very much for his time and for this interview. Before leaving you today, here is Professor Chomsky's quote about optimism one more time.
I think I was quoting Gramsci, who said we should have pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will.
If you would like a copy of today's interview, please download it from our website, moderntechnews.com. That's moderntechnews.com.